increasing the deportations from Mexico, essentially replicating the deportation practices that the U.S. had been engaged in. So we are hopeful that the new administration will again take a fresh look at this and reassess whether this is the right policy for Mexico, a nation that prides itself from saying that it is an international human rights leader. We just don't see that in practice, but we'd love to see that come to be the case with the new administration.
Oscar Chacon, we want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Alianza Americas. His recent essay, we'll link to it, Medium, Why Abolish ICE Doesn't Go Far Enough for Migrant Families. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Has a job opening for a broadcast engineer here in New York City. Find out more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gattestein, or Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez.
Good afternoon, Portland, the Northwest, and the world. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's 5 o'clock, and up next is your KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Rosewood Health Fair on Thursday, July 16th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Rosewood Family Health Center in Portland. The Rosewood Health Fair will provide health and wellness resources to the community, along with sports, physicals, and immunizations for children. There will be food, games, prizes, and a variety of community resources for families. Again, that's Rosewood Health Fair on Thursday, July 16th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Rosewood Family Health Center, 8935 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found on the kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Happy birthday!
The Oregon Historical Society is featuring 50 years of KBOO. The exhibit was created to relay our history and demonstrate the importance of community radio, featuring archival photographs and ephemera collected from KBOO's 5 decades of broadcasting. The exhibit tells our story in our members' own collective words. Our online tour features highlights from the exhibit and companion audio clips to enrich visitors' experiences. The exhibit runs until July 29th at the Oregon Historical Society at 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information and audio clips can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland police have cleared the ICE encampment.
Congress passes a bill to aid suicide prevention.
Scientists have found evidence of water on Mars.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 25th, 2018. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael wants to know, is it November yet?
I'm spending so much time on the edge of my seat, my legs got too numb to run. Will Julian Assange get ejected from the Ecuadorian embassy and into a British or American prison? Will Putin give Trump a present of Edward Snowden? Will enough Koch money pour into the Oregon election to get us a Republican governor, assuming there is an election? Will we get rain before October? When's the next mass shooting, the next huge wildfire? Will the children seeking asylum ever get their parents back? Can Trump spend a day without lying or contradicting himself? Will the Republicans let Mueller complete his job? There's no new sheriff coming, no costumed superhero. Can I spend this weekend binge-watching the future from now to November, get it over with, and hope next season has better plot lines and features new, more likable characters? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
After 5 weeks of occupation at the ICE building on Southwest McAdam Boulevard, the protest there has drawn to a close. Demonstrators calling for an end to the zero-tolerance immigration policy and even an end to ICE altogether had camped around the unmarked building since June 17th. The ICE building is a holding facility, meaning that immigrants are detained there for short periods of time before being processed and sent to other detention facilities outside of Portland, which is itself a sanctuary city. The number of protesters had dwindled in the past few weeks, but the remaining few were asked on Monday to leave by today or to face arrest. The camp was completely cleared of protesters without any arrests, and no pepper spray or other such munitions were used by the police. Police Chief Daniel Outlaw cited fire hazards and medical concerns as justification for the police action, and Mayor Ted Wheeler also gave his personal approval last Monday. On that same Monday, OHSU had originally told K2 Channel 2 that the organization had received no complaints about access to the medical facilities. OHSU's spokesperson, Franny White, changed the organization's stance yesterday in a public statement, also published in the Portland Mercury, saying OHSU respects the rights of citizens to demonstrate, but was concerned that demonstrations could disrupt OHSU operations. Although as many as 18 arrests were previously made at the camp, they were all carried out by federal officers. The grounds for the arrests were trespassing on federal property. Demonstrators had been moved from the side of the building to an area nearby. The front of the building had been blockaded and guarded by officers of the Department of Homeland Security. The building was reopened and has been functioning since early July, meaning that immigrants are being detained within the facility. The camp is now being cleaned out. Some neighbors are relieved, having reported that they felt unsafe with the camp nearby. A nonprofit food cart on Bancroft had also closed due to the protests. However, with the Occupy ICE chapter over, it might be time to continue forward with more mindful protests. Every second Thursday for almost a year, the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice has held silent vigils at the ICE building. Keep an eye on their website for updates on future vigils if you're looking for other ideas on how to protest ICE. Whatever the implications, it seems like the status quo has been fully restored at the ICE building, a sanctuary city's very own immigration detention facility.
After official eviction notices were given out to campers Monday to evacuate the Occupy ICE PDX camp by July 24th, a few dozen people remained at the camp after last night's vigil. Some people at the camp were removing their valuables in anticipation for a sweep, while some delivered an Abolish ICE chant aimed at the ICE entrance where several DHS agents loitered. The time of the DHS camp sweep was anticipated at midnight, and multiple press organizations were stationed with cameras outside the camp as midnight approached. Between 10:30 and 11, alt-right activists, including Joey Gibson, arrived at the camp entrance, throwing trash over the barricade and harassing the camp. Eventually, the group settled across the street and commenced in a shouting match against the demonstrators behind the Occupy ICE PDX barricade. The mutual ridicule lasted for about 30 minutes, then died down after an hour. Dozens of people began to gather through the night. Patriot Prayer and Proud Boy members and supporters continued to antagonize the camp into the early hours of the morning by playing Vanilla Ice and saying Proud Boys had more, quote, colored people than the Occupy ICE camp. The insults fired up another round of shouting while the Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys contingent made circles around the perimeter of the camp's boundaries. People in Antifa garb arrived shortly afterward and stood watch. 15 minutes after midnight, the alt-right activists dispersed, as did most of the press. The law enforcement sweep occurred hours later at approximately 4:30 a.m. It was a poignant last night of the camp, where a crowd came for a spectacle that instead ended in an anticlimax, the same fate as many Portland movements that start in ardor and end in confusion and malaise.
Only Donald Trump could make a 40-year-long Republican become a Democrat. Multnomah County Commissioner Lori Stegman said yesterday that she's made the change because, quote, I cannot condone the misogyny, the racism, and the unethical and immoral behavior of the current administration. She said she's a political moderate, in part due to her experience growing up in a district which includes Gresham, Troutdale, Corbett, and other small East County towns. Stegman further stated, I have not changed, but the Republican Party most certainly has.
This morning in Tigard, Daniel Bolchild was attempting to cross 99W in his wheelchair when he was hit and killed by a large semi-truck. The driver did not receive any citations. Local Tigard police discovered that Bolchild was intoxicated and did not use a crosswalk. He was a resident at a nearby healthcare facility and did not have any locatable family members.
James Lambert Otis was recorded vandalizing President Donald Trump's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame using a pickaxe and a jackhammer. Trump's star has been the subject of many vandalism attempts since he was elected in 2017. In the recording, Otis was seen carrying a guitar case that held the tools used to demolish the star. Otis turned himself in because security in the area are not granted the same privileges as federal law enforcement to intervene with criminals. Otis will serve 3 years probation, 20 days of community service, and pay $4,400 in damages.
According to a new report from the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University, more people than ever are being purged from voter registration rolls. The report, titled Purges, A Growing Threat to the Right to Vote, examines changes in voter restrictions since the Shelby County v. Holder Supreme Court case in 2013. The decision struck down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which required southern states with a history of voter discrimination to clear any changes to their voting laws with the federal government in a process called preclearance. Between 2014 and 2016, some states have removed almost 16 million voters from their rolls, nearly 4 million more than between 2006 and 2008. The growth in voter purges was greatest in states that previously needed preclearance, such as Georgia, which purged 1.5 million between the 2012 and 2016 elections. That's twice the number of voters removed between 2008 and 2012. As Michael Harriet wrote in The Root, quote, "These are not random isolated cases. It is a methodical effort that disproportionately affects minority voters. The purges specifically target voters with common last names and people who have moved."
In Pennsylvania, a man was shot and killed in the parking lot of the Red Rose Restaurant and Lounge after defending his friend, who is black, from racist remarks and harassment. Chad Merrill and Gerald Douglas were meeting friends when Douglas became the target of harassment. A man, identified as James Saylor, began yelling racial slurs at Douglas. Merrill told his friend to ignore the man. Saylor was kicked out of the bar, and Douglas did not engage with him. Outside of the bar, Saylor was attempting to get into other people's vehicles when he pulled a firearm from his waist and randomly shot at the building. He then got into his own vehicle. Merrill left the bar to confront the man when he was shot in the chest through the window of the vehicle. A crowd of people gathered around his body in the parking lot. Saylor escaped and crashed into another car as he was leaving the parking lot. Local law enforcement tracked down Saylor, who was living in his parents' basement, and arrested him. He's been charged with criminal homicide and is being held without bail. The Red Rose Restaurant and Lounge wrote on their Facebook page, "We would like to extend most heartfelt condolences to the Merrill family. Please know that our sincere thoughts and prayers are with you." A GoFundMe page has been set up for Merrill's funeral expenses, which has already raised $60,000, much more than the $15,000 that was the goal. The remainder of the money will go towards Merrill's newborn son.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A group of Pueblo women, children, and their allies called for environmental protection and Native rights at the Conference of Western Attorneys General annual meeting held Tuesday in Santa Ana, Pueblo, New Mexico. Demonstrators wanted to let Speaker U.S. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke know they're against fracking in the state. Native and environmental groups are working to protect Chaco Canyon, a sacred site and ancestral place, from oil and gas development. Eileen Shendo, Jemez, and Cochiti held a sign with the words, "Pueblo women say no." Shendo says, as a voting citizen of New Mexico, a Pueblo woman and mother, her message to federal officials is to listen to Native women's concerns.
So we had a few individuals set up pretty much within the hotel that were at a point able to read out the United Nations Declaration on Indigenous People and some of the other, like the mission statement of, you know, Department of Energy, and in a way that would allow for a reminder, you know, especially as all these governors were convening and tribal leaders to talk about, you know, this industry and what it's doing, but also a reminder that our natural resources and environment were needing to be protected.
Shendo says tribal sovereignty and treaty rights need to be included in discussions. National Native News reached out to the Interior Department for comment, but did not hear back by deadline. Twitter posts from Secretary Ryan Zinke's account about Tuesday's meeting said there were talks about offshore mineral leasing, water resources, and the reorganization of the Department of the Interior. A Santa Fe organization is canceling a controversial reenactment of Spanish conquistadors. The Santa Fe New Mexican reports stakeholders for the pageant, known as the Entrada, concluded months of negotiations with an agreement to retire the annual event, saying it does not adequately represent the true context of oppression and conflict leading up to and following the Pueblo Revolt. Protests by Pueblo people say the event glorifies a painful and bloody history. The group has not decided on how to replace the reenactment. A hunger relief group has a new report out on food insecurity, which applies to people who may have enough food to eat today, but are not sure about food for the near future. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
In South Dakota, six counties have food insecurity rates above 20%. All six are on or adjacent to tribal lands. Hunger relief advocates say these are the worst areas for people who aren't certain where tomorrow's meals may come from. Jennifer Stensis with Feeding South Dakota says residents at or just above the federal poverty level are able to get some assistance to feed their families.
But then you have another group of people who are at the 185% of poverty level that are just making enough to get by. They make just a little bit too much to qualify for any assistance. But what we find is those are the people that most often need our help, is because they're getting help nowhere else. They make just, you know, a dollar too much. They've got a little bit too much here, a little bit too much there, and puts them in this category of, what do? We need food.
Stensis says those families are forced to rely on food banks.
One of the biggest talking points, of course, is that number of those that are no longer eligible for food assistance, that number keeps rising. So this year we're at 40%. It keeps going up a little bit more in most counties across South Dakota. So we're really focusing on that, trying to understand that issue and see where we are needed.
Stensis says Feeding South Dakota tries to fill in gaps with services like mobile food pantries and commodity distribution efforts. A new program involves the head coaches from South Dakota's two Division I football programs to raise awareness and funds. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
This morning, U.S. District Judge Peter J. Mestite from Greenbelt, Maryland, rejected President Trump's latest efforts to stop a lawsuit that alleges he is violating the Constitution by profiting from businesses with foreign governments. The ruling will allow the plaintiffs, the Attorneys General of Maryland and the District of Columbia, to proceed with the case that argues that Trump has violated the Constitution's Emoluments Clause. The Trump Organization has not commented, but the Justice Department said in a statement, "We continue to maintain that this case should be dismissed." The plaintiffs now want to interview Trump Organization employees and search company records to determine which foreign countries spent money at the Trump Hotel in downtown Washington and how much they paid. They may also ask to review Trump's tax returns, which, unlike past presidents, have not been made public.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo testified today in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Questions focused on President Trump's summits with Russian President Vladimir Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Many committee members asked specifically about the Helsinki summit and Trump's two-hour closed-door meeting with Putin. Immediately preceding his testimony, Pompeo asserted that the U.S. will never recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea and demanded that Ukraine's territorial integrity be restored. Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, who is the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, stated, quote, "You come before a group of senators today who are filled with serious doubts about this White House and its conduct of American foreign policy." Corker added, quote, "We are antagonizing our friends and placating those who clearly wish us ill." Corker went on to call Trump submissive and deferential with regards to Putin and Russia. The top Democrat on the committee, Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey, said that Trump, quote, "provides legitimacy to the world's most notorious bad actors." Speaking on Trump's closed-door meeting with Putin, Menendez argued that, quote, "we don't know what the truth is because nobody else was in the room when it happened." Pompeo argued that Trump is, quote, "well aware of the challenges that Russia poses and that the president has taken a, quote, staggering number of actions to protect our interests." On election interference specifically, Pompeo testified to the committee that the president, quote, "has a complete and proper understanding of what happened," adding, quote, "I briefed him on it for over a year." Concerning North Korea, Pompeo testified that, quote, "the objective remains the final fully verified denuclearization of North Korea as agreed to by Chairman Kim Jong-un." After Pompeo repeatedly avoided answering certain questions, Menendez responded by saying, quote, "You're not going to answer any of the questions that would get us to the truth."
In 2012, Lucy McBath went through the terrible tragedy of losing her son. McBath's son, Jordan Davis, who was 17 years old at the time, was shot and killed after getting into a dispute with a man over loud music. Since then, McBath has testified before Congress on gun control and campaigned on behalf of the Mothers of the Movement, a group of mothers who have lost children to gun violence, police brutality, or both. According to CNN projections, McBath has won the Democratic nomination in the 6th Congressional District of Georgia. McBath defeated Kevin Abel, a businessman, in a runoff election and will challenge Republican Representative Karen Handel in November. The battle for Georgia's 6th district is seen by Democrats as a chance to test the viability of gun control as a platform in wealthy suburban districts. For McBath, the election is not just about testing a platform, rather it's about striving for justice. McBath told CNN that the actions of the students from Parkland, Florida, inspired her to enter the congressional race. She stated, "What I began to recognize is that I can keep helping to build this national movement and organize for gun violence prevention. But you've got to have people on the inside that are willing to do the work, creating the bills and the initiatives who will push the issue. You've got to have gun sense champions on the inside." McBath continued, "Until I'm able to create real, hard, systematic change, broad change that saves a large number of lives, there's no justice. We've got children dying in the classroom. Where's the justice in that?" The congressional hopeful wants to be a strong voice in Washington on behalf of activists like those from Parkland. McBath's congressional race remains rooted in her son, Jordan Davis. As she prepares to battle for a congressional seat, McBath said, "I'm still a mother. I'm still parenting. That's why I believed that this was the time to stand up."
A suspect has been arrested after the president's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, the target of previous attacks, was demolished with a pickaxe. According to the Los Angeles Times, the LAPD received a call from the man who allegedly took a pickaxe to the president's star on the strip in L.A. Reports claim the suspect arrived with a guitar case before taking out the implement to destroy the star. After fleeing the scene before officers arrived, the suspect turned himself in and is now in police custody. A source claims he most likely will be charged with felony vandalism. The Guardian writes that private security was in the area, but they struggled to intervene as they do not possess the same powers as law enforcement officers. This is not the first time the star has been attacked in recent times. The Guardian writes that in 2016, James Lambert Otis, 53, was recorded using a jackhammer and pickaxe to remove Trump's name. Otis claimed he was motivated by the infamous Access Hollywood video in which the future president used lewd terminology to describe his infidelity and sexual harassment of women. Otis was sentenced to 3 years probation, 20 days of community service, and paid $4,440 for the damage. The Guardian writes that Trump's star has also been the subject of protest art, with a wall erected around it in 2016 to symbolize the president's policy on immigration. The strip in Hollywood features multiple stars dedicated to celebrities, with 2018 honorees including Jeff Goldblum, Jack Black, Kirsten Dunst, and Zoe Saldana. Recipients are selected by a committee that considers applications throughout the year, and the stars are purchased for $30,000.
Congress has passed a bill that will require the U.S. government to look into establishing a national three-digit code that will connect people to a suicide prevention hotline. The bill, known as H.R. 2345, was co-authored by two Utah Republicans, Senator Orrin Hatch and Representative Chris Stewart. Federal government agencies will now perform a cost and benefit analysis of the hotline's creation and provide recommendations to improve the overall effectiveness of the current system. The hotline will work similarly to the 911 emergency system. Callers will dial a three-digit number and then be connected to mental health professionals staffed by the hotline. The goal is to increase dedicated resources to those in need. This is expected to be especially helpful to LGBTQ youth, considering that they have a higher suicide rate than their straight or cisgender peers. Suicide rates are even higher for trans individuals. Representative Stewart stated, "These are truly heartbreaking statistics, and sadly, they hit close to home. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline Improvement Act is a bipartisan and common sense piece of legislation that has the ability to save lives. If you or someone you know is in crisis, the current Suicide Prevention Lifeline can be reached at 1-800-273-8255.
Per The Intercept, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont has introduced new legislation aimed at ending money bail in federal cases. The bill also incentivizes states to follow the bill's lead. The legislation, named the No Money Bail Act, is the latest attempt to introduce criminal justice reform. Sanders' bill would prohibit money bail in all criminal cases at the federal level and would provide grants to the states that follow suit, while withholding funding for states who continue using the system. According to Sanders' summary of the bill, the act also requires a study 3 years after implementation to ensure the new alternate systems are not leading to disparate detention rates. Sanders asserts that, quote, "It has always been clear that we have separate criminal justice systems in this country for the poor and for the rich. A wealthy person charged with a serious crime may get an ankle monitor and be told not to leave the country. A poor person charged with a misdemeanor may sit in a jail cell. And this disproportionately affects minorities. 50% of all pretrial detainees are Black or Latinx." Sanders also disparages the debtor's prison system that money bail reinforces in the United States. In a statement accompanying the summary of the bill, Sanders wrote, quote, "Poverty is not a crime, and hundreds of thousands of Americans convicted of nothing should not be in jail today because they cannot afford cash bail. Our destructive and unjust cash bail process is part of our broken criminal justice system and must be ended."
Two similar bills introduced by Representative Ted Lieu of California were shot down in the House in 2016 and 2017. Sanders' bill is the latest in a line of attempted legislation from the left that aims to reduce and eliminate race and class disparities in the criminal justice system. Another bill with similar goals was introduced last month by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. It aims to decriminalize marijuana and remove it from the Controlled Substances Act. According to the ACLU, for-profit prisons make between $1.4 and $2.4 billion annually, while defendants who cannot afford bail stay behind bars regardless of whether they have been convicted of a crime. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, approximately 60% of people in jails across the U.S. in 2014 had not been convicted of any crime. In the summary of his bill, Sanders asserts, "Pretrial detention should be based on whether or not someone truly should not be freed before their trial. It should not depend on how much money they have or what kind of mood the judge is in on a given day." Sanders also went on to warn that eliminating money bail must be watched closely to ensure that new forms of discrimination are not implemented in its place. The bill may struggle to get through Congress, but momentum for criminal justice legislation is growing at all levels of government.
VIP. Let's kick it. Ice, ice, baby. Ice, ice, baby. All right, stop, collaborate, and listen. Ice is back with my brand new invention. Something grabs a hold of me tightly. Flow like a harpoon daily and nightly. Will it ever stop? Yo, I don't know. Turn off the lights and I'll glow. To the extreme, I rock a mic like a vandal. Light up a stage and wax a chump like a candle. Dance. Crush the speaker that boom.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's The Underground. That's followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather is clear with a low of 65 degrees. Tomorrow it will be sunny with a high of 92 degrees. Today in history, in 1978, Louise Joy Brown, the world's first baby to be conceived via in vitro fertilization, was born in Manchester, England. Quote of the day is from Bob Dylan, who shocked the folk music world in 1965 when he appeared at the Newport Folk Festival with electric instruments. "He's not busy being born, he's busy dying."
With a souped up tempo, I'm on a roll, it's time to go solo. Rolling, hit my 5.0, put my rag top down so my hair can blow. The girl is on standby, waiting just to say hi. Did you stop? No, I just drove by, kept on, pursuing to the next.
On Monday, 8 people were killed in a suicide bombing at a mosque in Nigeria. Civilians were preparing for early morning prayers in the village of Konduga when a man entered the mosque and detonated the bomb, killing himself as well as 7 civilians. Law enforcement in the state of Borno said that while there is no exact motive for the attack, they believe that the terrorist group Boko Haram could be responsible. Boko Haram is well known in Nigeria, where they often target public areas such as mosques and markets. This attack follows a bombing that occurred last month, where 20 people were killed in what is called a double bomb blast.
It has been 20 years since Ethiopia and Eritrea have associated with each other following their border war. Now, phone lines between the two countries are being reopened. Telecom companies in Ethiopia will again be able to connect phone lines with neighboring Eritrea. On Monday, a message was sent out to nearly 57 million users announcing that they could now make calls to Eritrea. Many Ethiopians and Eritreans were able to contact and connect with family and friends after years of separation. The prime ministers of both nations met at a summit in Eritrea, ending the border war. They signed a joint declaration that will allow airlines to fly between the countries and will also establish new embassies and ports.
In June of 2017, a 10-minute video was released in Russia that showed prisoners in a Yaroslavl prison located northeast of Moscow. A Russian human rights lawyer, Irina Biryukova, published the video, resulting in the arrest of many other prison guards involved. Now, both implicated and uninvolved guards at the prison want Biryukova dead. Biryukova fled Russia after employees at the prison sent death threats to her family and to her organization. The video in question showed uniformed Yaroslavl prison employees pinning down a prisoner as they beat him for complaining about being brutalized. The man screamed for mercy while the attackers hit him with unknown objects, targeting the prisoner's limbs and abdomen. Biryukova stated, "Unfortunately, these types of beatings are not uncommon in Russia. It happens so often that even officials from the Federal Penitentiary Service don't hide it." Multiple human rights organizations are demanding the Russian government investigate the treatment of their prisoners, as well as the backlash against Biryukova.
At least three people were killed and many more injured by Israeli artillery fire and airstrikes in eastern Gaza today. The United Nations had previously negotiated a ceasefire with Egyptian mediators to prevent violence from escalating. Although a ceasefire was agreed upon between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups, Israel has continued bombing the Gaza Strip. No Palestinian shells have been fired in retaliation during the ceasefire. Although Israeli media is claiming that the Palestinians fired first, live streams on Twitter and Facebook show the drone strikes occurring before Palestinians began shooting toward the Israeli military base. Two Israeli soldiers were also wounded in the gunfire. In the past 100 days, Israeli forces have killed 147 Palestinians, while more than 17,000 have been injured for participating in nonviolent protests along the dividing lines between Gaza and Israel. One Israeli soldier was also killed, the first death on the Israeli side since 2014. A Hamas spokesperson, Fawzi Barum, stated the scope of the deliberate Israeli attack on the fighters reveals that Israel has the intention of killing. It is impossible to sit idly by in the face of Israel's crimes. The resistance forces will not give up their duty to respond to this aggression and defend the Palestinian people. A spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces said, quote, "The IDF will act against any attempt to harm the sovereignty of the state of Israel and the security of its residents." Over 2 million Palestinians live in the Gaza Strip, which has been described as the world's largest open-air prison. Although Israeli troops withdrew from Gaza in 2005, they maintain tight control of its borders, which has reduced the Palestinian economy to a state of collapse.
A bombing outside of a polling station in Quetta, Pakistan, has killed at least 31 people and injured dozens more in what has become an intensely violent election campaign. ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack. However, this has not been verified by any security apparatus. Earlier this month, a suicide bombing in the same province killed 150 people, which led some to argue that the election should be delayed. Today, voters decided between the party of retired cricket star Imran Khan and the party of the jailed former premier Nawaz Sharif. Imran Khan, the leader of the Pakistani Tehreek-e-Insaf Justice Party, or PTI, is a cricket player turned politician who ran on an anti-corruption platform. Khan has denied accusations that he is unjustly supported by the military. His main opponent, Shahbaz Sharif, is the leader of the incumbent Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, or PMLN, and is the brother of jailed former ruler Nawaz Sharif. Before entering the election, Shahbaz Sharif was the chief minister of the Punjabi province. This is the second time in Pakistan's 71-year history that the country has had a democratic transition of power. However, this has been overshadowed by fears of political instability and interference by the military. Some political parties argue that their election monitors were asked to leave polling stations before tallying was finished, or they did not receive the final tallies. The Secretary of Pakistan's Election Commission disputed these claims, saying many of the monitors from parties that were not performing well left the polling stations without taking their forms. In Pakistan's general election, the majority of the 342 members for the National Assembly are elected by 272 single-member districts. 60 seats are reserved for women and 10 for ethnic or religious minorities. To hold a simple majority, a party would need to win at least 172 seats. Early speculation from local media suggests that Khan's party will win between 94 and 102 assembly seats. However, not all the votes have been counted. The incumbent party, the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, has already rejected the election results.
A team of Italian scientists announced today that they have strong evidence of a subsurface lake of liquid water near the South Pole of Mars. The scientists noticed the 12-mile-wide lake in 2015 using ground-penetrating radar aboard the European Space Agency's Mars Express spacecraft that orbits the planet. Since then, they have used other measurements to rule out alternative possibilities and recently published a report in Science magazine. Because the water in the Martian underground lake is not frozen, it most likely contains perchlorate salts, which are toxic to life on Earth, but may not be toxic to life on Mars.
Up next, we have another installment of Retired or Rewired. How do scammers target the elderly, and what can you do to avoid getting ripped off? KBOO News speaks with Ellen Clem, Director of Consumer Outreach at the Office of the Attorney General for the State of Oregon. Ellen is a lawyer who formerly worked for the American Bar Association. Her job is to educate seniors on how to be savvy consumers and to avoid scams.
Here's our series on aging in Portland. Retired or rewired? What it's like getting old in a youth-centered city. Are you up for that challenge? We'll bring you lots of views, but you'll have to answer this question for yourself. Is Portland a good place in which to grow old? Ellen Clem is our guest today. Ellen is the Director of Consumer Outreach and Education in the Office of the Attorney General of the State of Oregon. Ellen, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ellen, you've got a big job, and we are focusing on one aspect of it, that is scamming the elderly. Is that a big industry in Oregon? Is there a lot of fraud directed against the elderly?
Well, let me just clarify. My job is not scamming the elderly. My job is keeping the elderly safe from scams.
Oh, sorry.
I don't want to confuse your listeners.
No.
But yes, it is a big job to keep older adults in the state of Oregon safe from fraud and scams. And I love doing it. It's a challenge, but it's a different challenge every day, and it definitely keeps me entertained and working hard.
Can you give us an idea of how big this scamming business is in terms of arrests or convictions, dollar values, anything?
I wish I could, but it's really difficult to quantify with numbers, and there's a number of reasons for that. The biggest reason, unfortunately, is that individuals who fall victim to a fraud or a scam in the state, and all states, in fact, across the country, are hesitant to report that they've lost money or been a victim of identity theft for a number of reasons, but the important reason is that they're embarrassed.
Okay, what are the most common types of scams that you find used against the elderly? Can you tell us that?
Well, I would definitely like to talk about how the phone is used as a tool to commit fraud against older Oregonians.
Let's talk about the phone.
The phone is sort of the bane of my existence, because when I was growing up, I'm almost 40, and I was taught that you answered every single phone call and you were polite to the caller on the other end, and I assume that many of your listeners were taught the same thing. And it's very difficult to navigate the new world of fraud and scams that comes over the telephone line, because we really probably shouldn't be answering every phone call that comes our way, and we definitely shouldn't be polite to these callers that are trying to take our money, our identity, and other personal information.
Are you saying that we should let our calls go into the answering mode?
I think that's a great idea. You know, my mom does that. She lets every phone call go to her answering machine.
People with landlines at home are targeted easily. Is that right?
That is true. So gone are the days that, when I was growing up, the phone book came to my front step and my neighbor's front steps, and that was about as far as it went. Nowadays, everything is online, including the phone book.
So the advice from Ellen and the Attorney General is don't answer the phone right away and get rid of that listing on the phone book.
I think that's good advice. I would also encourage your listeners, if they do answer the phone, they should hang up if they see a number, or hear, excuse me, a number of signs, warning signs.
Well, that raises the question of a publication you have on your website, which anyone can read, 6 signs it's a scam. What are they?
Yes, that is a very popular handout that we produced several years ago. The first sign of a scam is that the scammer or the fraudster contacts you out of the blue. We were talking earlier about the weather turning warm and people outside gardening and having an individual drive by and stop and say something akin to, gosh, it looks like you could really use a new roof. That's a little bit out of the blue. Same with phone calls, the IRS imposter scam, the grandparent scam. These are all phone calls out of the blue. You didn't know that you owed money to the IRS. You had no idea that your grandson was going to be traveling to Mexico or Canada. So that contact out of the blue is the first sign that it's a scam.
You're talking about a scam that's ongoing about the installation of burglar alarms. What do we have to worry about there?
Sure. So as the weather gets warmer, we're going to see a lot more of these door-to-door sales. And not all of them are scammers, but we see an uptick this time of year. And before I left to come to your show today, I checked in with my team, and they wanted me to mention the fact that they're seeing a rise in the number of complaints associated with alarm companies and scam alarm companies. A variety of complaints have come into our office in the past couple weeks, but the gist is basically somebody comes to the door, says they have a great deal that you can't refuse on an alarm system. They install the alarm. They do pretty, not great work. And then they bill you for something that's significantly higher than what you agreed upon. Or perhaps the alarm system doesn't work at all. Or even in one awful, very rare, hopefully rare situation, we had an individual who had installed an alarm system on an older woman's house and then came back several days later to rob her.
Or they could be installing an alarm system that actually listens into your conversations.
Oh gosh, we haven't had any complaints about that, but the scammers are, they're always trying new things, so I wouldn't be surprised to hear it.
Sounds like a Lexus to me. You made me aware of the issue of carrying your Medicare card.
Yes.
I had not thought about this. I have it in my pocket right now. What's the issue there?
The issue there is if you carry your Medicare card in your wallet or your purse, you are at risk of identity theft. If that wallet or purse is stolen and your card is in there, the card contains extremely sensitive information, your Social Security number.
We talked a little bit about charities.
Well, during the end of the year, we see a lot of scams related to charitable giving. Typically, that involves scam charities or scams or charities that have popped up overnight. We encourage Oregonians to do their research before they give to any charity. And you can do that on our website, which is OregonConsumer.gov.
You talked about prepaid cards. What is it about prepaid cards that's so dangerous?
The prepaid cards are those cards that you see at Safeway, Walgreens, Rite Aid, etc. The scammers want you to go to one of these establishments like Fred Meyer, buy a card, load it with a couple $100, and then call the scammer back, read them the number on the back of the card, and while you're doing that, they're entering it into their computer system and instantly draining the money from that.
No.
And it's very quick, it's fast, and you can do it after the banks are closed.
How can a consumer who's been the victim of a fraud contact you?
Our website is really easy. It's OregonConsumer.gov. Then we also have a toll-free consumer hotline that's staffed Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 4:30 by volunteers, real live people who answer the phone. And that number's pretty easy as well. It's 1-877-877-9392.
Our guest today, Ellen Clem from the State Department of Justice. Ellen, thank you for joining us here.
Thank you for having me.
That was the 10-minute version of a 30-minute interview that you can hear on our website. You've been listening to our series on Aging in Portland, Retired or Rewired. You can listen to any episode in this series or the entire series if you go to kboo.fm and look for the show under my name, Tom Flynn. Thanks for joining us today.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Lucas Campbell, Calvin Thompson, CJ Fritz, Yasmin Kobanoglu, and Summer Barraza. The producer is Kyle Carrezzi. Our engineer and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zella Celis Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock on Sojourner Truth Radio, the Anti-Police Terror Network weighs in on the killing of Nia Wilson on the Bay Area Transit System. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia features headlines, interviews, and commentary, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, David Nyman talks to Forrest Gander about his new book of poems, Be With. And at 11:30, the film show welcomes legendary Portland filmmaker Gus Van Sant to KBOO to talk about his new movie, Don't Worry, He Won't Get Far on Foot. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, you can do so right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.